Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of June. We're going to look at the airline industry this hour of the program. It's been called an airline catastrophe, actually a looming catastrophe under record oil prices. A study by the Airline Forecast and Business Travel Coalition says that as a consequence of the skyrocketing price of oil, the U.S. commercial aviation industry is in full-blown crisis and is heading toward a catastrophe. With current oil prices near $130 a barrel, several large and small U.S. airlines will default on their obligations to creditors beginning at the end of 2008 and early 2009. It's a grim industry snapshot and comes as U.S. airlines cut fleets, jobs, capacity, and as many of you travelers know, add fees as they struggle with spiraling jet fuel costs and a weak domestic economy. On Thursday of last week, United Airlines and U.S. Airways announced they would start charging $15 for the first checked bag, and both carriers this month, because of the latest to try downsizing to survive the fuel crisis. Daryl Jenkins is our guest. Daryl is an airline consultant, a visiting professor at the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050, or send an email at talk@wpr.org. Hi, Daryl. Thanks so much for being with us.
How are you,
young lady? Good. How are you?
Fine. Beautiful day here in Virginia.
Yeah, same here in Wisconsin for change. It's really nice. What about this description of the industry? Would you agree with this? A U.S. airline catastrophe is looming under record oil prices.
Well, just about everything that happens in the airline is a catastrophe, and this is a certainly no different. Fuel costs for most American-based airlines are now the largest operating expense that comprises about 30% of their operating costs, higher than labor. We've never seen any thing like this before. It looks like it will get worse. And so, yes, things do look bleak.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way around it, other than the prices of oil coming down, and that doesn't look very likely, right?
Well, the price of oil, if that doesn't come down, then we're going to have to continue reducing capacity to the point where the revenue generated per plane is sufficient to cover this huge oil expense.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what it is that airlines have already started doing to counter this. We've heard about charging for the first checked bag, and no longer any pretzels even. Are there other things that airlines are doing that are helping in any substantial way to help with their profits?
I think that every airline that I know and work with, which is just about all of them right now, is looking at any form of ancillary revenue that they feel they can get away with. They'll probably add these slowly. The bag check had been tossed about for the last 5 or 6 years, done with a great deal of trepidation, but appears to be sticking today with American, United, and U.S. Airways doing it right now. So anything they can do to generate more revenue, which could include some things which would be less harsh to the customers, such as trying to earn more revenue in terms of hotel bookings and car rentals.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Allegiant Airlines, which is in Las Vegas and the only airline in the United States right now with a long-term viable business plan, gets about 15 to 20% of their revenue through those type of bookings. So certainly that's something that people are going to be looking at much more closely.
Mm-hmm. How many airlines do you expect to go out of business by the end of 2008 or move on to 2009?
Well, I don't know that anybody is going to go out of business. Certainly the larger carriers, the top 10, I doubt any of them will go out of business this year. With everybody that with the thing being on capacity cuts and getting more pricing power, if in fact a larger airline did go out of business, it would probably make everybody else stronger, and that would probably lead to a better long-term industry. I doubt in the United States we're going to see much capacity growth over the next 5 to 10 years if we see oil prices at this level, so liquidating perhaps one carrier might not be harmful whatsoever.
Except you won't be able to get to where you want to go, right? Or you'll have to stop 10 times?
You'll always be able to get to where you want to go. If there's sufficient demand, you'll just have to pay a higher price.
Right, and how much higher are we talking?
Well, let's see. We'll probably be, over the next 2 years, we'll probably see another 20% increase in fares, at least attempted.
20%? That's substantial, isn't it?
It is indeed, young lady.
The oil at $130 a gallon, these figures are staggering, will increase the yearly airline costs by $30 billion.
Yeah, and that's more money than we've ever made in a year. So you know that with figures this big, something's going to have to change. But, you know, I mean, we all understand what's going on because we see what this is doing to our own pocketbooks and to our own household budgets.
Right.
We're all having to make changes in the way we consume, the way we live, what we buy, and things like this. So this is hurting everybody. And, I mean, the ripple effect is just going to be enormous. Hotels in places like Las Vegas have been doing a lot of building. But at the same time, the places that are going to take the biggest cut in airline capacity are going to be leisure destinations like Las Vegas, Orlando, and especially Hawaii, where you have no alternative form of transportation out there almost.
Right.
So we're going to see a lot of hurt in this economy as long as prices stay this much. Most of the plans that I saw airlines do for capacity this year were benchmark somewhere around $90 to $95 a barrel. So if we could even get down to $100 a barrel, we'd have a sustainable model. At $130 a barrel, probably other than Allegiant Airlines in the United States, there's no carrier that has a long-term viable business plan right now.
Mm-hmm. What about this? The study said that stabilizing this ailing industry must become a national policy priority. What kind of policies could be put in place to help the situation, Daryl?
No, I don't know. I mean, things like that are always, kind of nice things to say.
Right, yeah.
The truth is we live in a country that has no long-term policy in terms of infrastructure. We have no long-term policy in terms of energy or anything else. So the likelihood of that happening in the next year is very remote.
Yeah. We talk about alternatives to oil for cars, and we're talking a lot about that. Is there an alternative to flying an airplane?
Well, there are, but they're down the road a piece. Boeing and Virgin did a flight on biodiesel, but, you know, if we were to convert all the farmland in the United States over to biodiesel, that would pretty much do it. There wouldn't be any farm left for food. So we're talking about some technologies that are all next-generation technologies. You know, for example, if we could move to grass or something like that, or corn stalks, the cellulosic biomass, then we could just use the state of Delaware and that small state's farmland, if entirely dedicated to biodiesel, could fuel the United States airline industry. So, yes, it can happen. There are alternatives out there, but they all involve technologies which are currently not available commercially.
Right. Is this problem affecting the airline industry all over the world, Daryl?
Yes, everybody is taking fallout from it. Some of them, it's hurting less. So carriers such as KLM or Singapore are being hit by this, but less. They fly longer stage lengths with more business passengers in them that are paying high fares going all over the world. So basically, as you diversify and get to longer stage lengths that are more fuel efficient and you have a higher number of business travelers in it, that's kind of your protection in all of this, which was essentially the idea behind the Delta Northwest merger as well.
Right. This report said that the industry, and this is not outside the range of possibility, with oil prices going to perhaps $135 range, the industry could be forced to park upward of 1,000 aircraft and shed over 80,000 employees. That has ripple effect for the whole economy.
Well, it does. And it's not just the airline industry that's hurting trucking.
Yes.
Railroad. So everything that we do, we're a petroleum-based economy, and we're kind of the lubrication that keeps everything going. So before the year is over at these prices, everybody is going to be hurting. Everybody's long-term plans in terms of consumption and how they behave are going to have to take some very significant changes. So we're just really beginning to feel the pain of this. This cannot be sustained, and something's going to have to happen.
So should we have thought about this a long time ago?
Well, I mean, we should have done a lot of things, you know. And I mean, what's interesting about this one, I think we all kind of had this scenario in mind of what we would do if jet fuel ever, or if a barrel of oil were around $100 a barrel. But we all thought that was so far down in the future, and it kind of happened so rapidly that our ability, not only within the airline, but all other industries as well, to react this quickly and sort of chronically has been quite incredible.
Yeah, why did it happen so rapidly?
Well, I don't know. That's beyond my area of expertise. The fact that it has happened so rapidly always gives me pause to wonder what the true forces behind this are.
Yeah. It does for all of us, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
what
we
is the truth
haven't seen
here?
That big of an increase in consumption, so, you know, I mean, we haven't seen a doubling in consumption. We've seen a big change in consumption with India and China economies coming online, but I think there's, to me, there's more than supply and demand at work here.
Daryl Jenkins is our guest, airline consultant, visiting professor at the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And we are talking about the U.S. airline industry, which is in pretty bad shape here because of the record oil prices, with current oil prices near $130 a barrel. Some of you have experienced what the airlines are doing. They're charging for first baggage. There are no pretzels or peanuts anymore. That's too bad. I mean, that's just a simple little thing, but you can't have pretzels or peanuts anymore. And there are people doing this study saying that, I don't know what they would do, that the people in Congress need to figure out some way to stabilize this ailing industry because it has, you know, loss of jobs, loss of flights, loss of tourism industry. It's a big deal. So what are your thoughts? Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And should you want to send us an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We had tons of phone calls. We'll go to them now at 800-486-8655. Daryl Jenkins, airline consultant and visiting professor at the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, is our guest. We start with Dave from Milwaukee. Hi, Dave.
Hi. My question is, there was a study done a long time ago. I believe it was Los Alamos Labs, so I'm not really sure. And they suggested that airlines, planes excel at long-distance flights, and that for all up to 300-400-mile corridors, high-speed rail might be a more efficient way to do this. Now, I know that in Europe, I think Virgin and even Lufthansa, they run their own dedicated trains from various points to an airport, and then people take the longer flight. Would that be a way to save money in this country? I mean, I know that I have a friend in La Crosse. He's in the nuclear power industry, and when he wants to fly somewhere, he has to get on a plane like in La Crosse and fly to the Twin Cities or to Milwaukee, and it costs him $500-$600. And with the current train, which you can't rely on, you can fly. You can take the train to the Twin Cities or Milwaukee for like $70 and then fly. But would high-speed trains on short corridors be a way to save on these fuel costs?
Well, that's a perfectly good question. I guess the reason I always take the show is you have good questions on it. The answer is yes. The problems are simple. However, it's always kind of this NIMBY idea that not in my backyard. So when I go from Northern Virginia to New York to my publisher, which is right across the street from the train station or in downtown New York, I always take the train. It's convenient. It's nice. It runs reasonably on schedule. fares are comparable to what an airline is. But being able to use high-speed rail through that area is very difficult, even with the Excella, because every time they want to strengthen the track, every time they want to increase the speed, you have neighborhoods there that are totally opposed to it and are able to block these things. So, yes, it's a good idea. The likelihood of it being implemented anytime soon is very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. Here's an email from Rick from Madison. It's interesting that the airlines have not just increased fares as a straightforward fuel surcharge, but have instead added fixed charges such as bag check fees and beverage fees, the purpose to get customers used to them so they can remain if the fuel costs ever go down. Would you agree?
Well, I mean, that's also a good question. The issue is transparency. So when you call in and you make your reservation, they quote you the fare. And then after you've said yes, then you get all of the add-ons, okay? And they tell you there's going to be a bag fee, but they don't figure that in. So you're kind of not getting everything you want. So it's not as transparent as perhaps the consumer would want it, which makes it easier to sell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the whole rationale for doing add-on fees rather than doing straight price increases. And sometimes price increases are very difficult to get through because basically, you do it, then you have to get all your neighbors to do it. And there's always one neighbor out there that's fearful or is wanting to retaliate for something you did against them. So it's an easier way to get a fare increase through. Now, I'd spoken with American about this, and they're telling me their rationale on this, which I think is reasonable, is that bags make up 10% of the weight of an aircraft. And as you take on weight in an airplane, your fuel consumption goes up. Matter of fact, 20% of the fuel that you carry on an airplane, you carry just to is there for the increased burn because you have so much fuel on board. Okay, so all of these things add up, and anytime you add significant amounts of weight to an airplane, you increase fuel burn. So to them, it's more cost related and trying to keep costs in line with revenues.
We go to Scott next. Thanks very much for your call, Dave. We go to Scott from driving. Are you driving, or where are you from?
Hi, I'm out on the road right now.
Okay, I wondered if it was the name of a town.
From La Crosse.
Okay.
sorry about that. I'm using up that gasoline. I'd like to say as an aside, I am somebody who considers myself a person who loves to fly but has come to hate air travel because of the way everything has turned out. But my question is about the impact of this on the manufacturers of aircraft. I know that both Airbus and Boeing, the two major builders, have talked about their most recent releases as betting the company. And I sure would hate to be Airbus having bet the company on a jumbo, a super jumbo jet this time. But then I'm thinking, well, Boeing's Dreamliner probably might not turn out to be such a brilliant move either. And I'm wondering if this will be one of these instances where some of these smaller regional jet type manufacturers like Embraer from, I think, Argentina, aren't they, or someplace. Anyhow, that these people might wind up eating the lunch of the major carriers just simply because they're going to have a market for smaller, more fuel-efficient aircraft. And I know it's tough to turn a big aircraft manufacturing company around on a dime to meet the current needs. And I'll shut up and get off the phone now so you can get the phone.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, very, very good question from the young man in the car. It's a very reasonable question. Let me answer it like this. Right now, the United States-based airlines are not buying any planes at all. And so what happens in the United States will have little impact on either Boeing or Airbus. The biggest buyer of airplanes out there right now is the Emirates, and that's where all of our money is going to. So some of their big planes will, in fact, be purchased and the orders put on the book. For the United States, probably the perfect-sized airplane is a 100-seater, which we've haven't used very often because of a pilot scope contracts where the airlines prefer to use outsourced labor, and and the pilots were able to restrict language that above a certain seat size they would get it.
Hmm.
But he is certainly right for shorter haul domestic flights, a small plane, a regional jet, a 100-seater, even though the unit costs are higher per person. Your total operating costs are lower, and it is the total cost, the bill at the end of the day, the difference between the plane full of revenue and the plane full of expenses is the metric that will decide which planes go where.
Interesting. Mark from Delafield, the industry always has excuses for its losses. It used to be labor costs, retirement plans, now it's fuel costs. Aren't these common costs for all the carriers? Why can't the lowest cost carriers like JetBlue make a profit? Should there be some regulation on airlines where they cannot charge below their cost to hurt the competition?
A good question again. JetBlue, the low-cost carriers are being hurt just as well as the legacy carriers, so your JetBlues, Air Trans. Southwest has some very good oil hedges in, but those are going to expire, and when they expire, they're going to have a very difficult time hedging, getting the same type of hedges that they previously had. So the low-cost carriers are being hurt significantly. In terms of legislation and things like that, I am kind of more of a hands-off, and here's the reason why. I do not think that a national policy should be ever designed to protect stupid companies. And so if a company is stupid enough to do something that harms itself, its employees, and its stockholders, then as in the United States, they have the right to be as stupid as they want to. What I hope is that we, from this, I've actually seen some reasonable behavior. And probably the best management decision-making I've ever seen in the airline industry, and I've been watching this longer than the kid who called in has been on this earth, probably. I've seen very good decisions being made. So if there's any bright areas out there from all of this, is that I'm seeing airline managers act more rationally and acting more in their own best interest than I've ever seen them before. You know, price of oil goes down. If they begin acting stupid again, who knows? But I'm not one who thinks that we should take our legislative time into protecting companies from their own stupidity.
Yeah. Let's go to Mary next from Madison. Hello, Mary.
Hello. Well, it seems clear that the quality of life is going to continue to decline for anybody except the super rich. All of us keep falling back on the railroads, especially those of us who got to travel on the railroads when it was still a lot of fun, as in being little kids. So my question is this. I've heard for many years that we've largely dismantled our national railroad system, and I'd appreciate it if the speaker could say what he might know about that and whether the railroads were ever and are now a real alternative to air travel, which we all love. Secondly, I have a couple of friends that work on the very high end of the computer system. They're systems integration engineers, and I'm always taken aback by how constantly they have to fly all over the country to do business with other companies. I wonder why at that level particularly you still have to go, we think, and meet face-by-face with people. And I wondered if the speaker could say something about, apart from account expense account fudging, what proportion of trips appear to be for business versus pleasure by air, and will the country really fall apart if we can't get there in a few hours to meet face-to-face?
All right. All good questions. I'm not sure to begin with. In terms of revenue, business travelers account for the plurality of the revenue to the airlines, which is different than the number of passengers. Okay. So at United Airlines, we used to use this metric that 8% of our customers accounted for 40% of our revenue. Okay. And it's those computer guys that are traveling over all over the world at the last minute to do business. And, yes, an important part of that is shoulder-to-shoulder. Some of it can be done away with through technology and video conferencing and things like this. But it's also sometimes necessary to have someone next to you as you're taking that wrench and turning that bolt, to have someone with you who is expert helping you make that turn as well. So a lot of it is needed. The bulk of the revenue to an airline comes from business travelers by far. It's not even a close comparison. And as you see capacity being pulled in, where are your biggest capacity cuts? It's not in business markets. So Seattle, from Washington Dulles, where you have AOL to Seattle, where they have Microsoft, they run that shuttle three times a day. United has the 757, which is always full of people. It's their most profitable route, what has been for years at least, was their most profitable route in their entire domestic system. So these things are very important. Orlando is facing very, very big cutbacks, as is Vegas and Hawaii and other leisure destinations. In terms of your questions on the railroad, we right now do not have the tracks, the infrastructure in place to really have either high-speed rail or good connections between cities. Railroads are a very interesting business. I've always liked trains. Europe does an excessively good job at trains. The United States does an excessively bad job at it. And I think that's by choice. So in Europe, you can go anywhere short haul on trains, which run reasonably well and are clean. Here in the United States, you have very few options on that. A lot of this was, for example, if you look the train that goes from Chicago to Seattle, JetBlue used to fly that route for $79, and Amtrak was running that. And you would see almost nobody going all the way from Chicago to Seattle on Amtrak. But you would see them going short distances on that route. And so the short distance segments would always have a lot of people on it, and nobody would be doing the long-haul travel on that Amtrak line. So it has been years since passenger travel has been profitable in the United States. On the other hand, cargo rail has been profitable for a very, very long time. So the railroads do a very, very good job at transporting cargo by train across the United States, and we, for the last 20 or 30 years, have done a very poor job of transporting passengers across. It will be interesting to see if any of our national priorities change. There's long been a call in Congress to withdraw any subsidies to Amtrak. I think at these oil prices, we might see that changing. And let me tell you, on the East Coast where I live, I can go between here and New York or New York and Boston very easily, very comfortably, and very conveniently on a train, and I really do enjoy those short-haul train rides.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Mary, for your call. Let's go next to Bob, who's on the road. Hi, Bob.
Hi, this is Bob. I'm driving from Prairie du Chien to Milwaukee to catch an airplane to fly home to Sacramento.
Oh.
And this whole trip, I had to come back and bury my mom, but this whole trip get back in, she wanted to come back to Wisconsin, and man, was it expensive compared to the same sort of trip last year. And because we are so reliant as a public on the air transportation system, my question is, previously the speaker had mentioned that about $100 per barrel would be a viable business plan for many of the major airlines to continue to provide this service to the public. And if it's that important a service, we give milk price supports and we give other farm supports. How come we don't put a cap of $100 as a government policy? I know you're against overall regulation, but to keep people from being stupid. But still, if they could come up with a viable business plan, if they're smart, at $100 a barrel, why don't we go ahead and subsidize them like we do the farmers, just so we can keep the same public service available to us?
Well, I guess it's a reasonable question. I'm trying to think of a different way to answer it here, because one, I just am opposed to a lot of those things. That's just a philosophical bent on my part. We will always have air travel. I don't think that the system's just going to collapse and fall apart. I mean, if we had one bankruptcy even or one big liquidation, it's going to change the number of seats there, and the remaining guys would probably all be stronger and have a long-term viable plan at $130 a barrel. So we use so many barrels, and it is just so much money. Ultimately becomes a matter of priorities and allocating. So you have anybody, even Congress, has a budget which they're less likely to put thought into than we are in our household. But at a certain point, I guess here are the things that we have to figure out as a nation. I mean, it goes back to when I was a young boy, and the argument was guns or butter. And that's where we're at right now. We do not have enough money in this country to do both. Now, in terms of infrastructure, our intercoastal seaways are silting over, and without the intercoastal waterways, boat travel, cargo travel along the East Coast is very, very difficult and would become very enormously expensive. I was driving through Connecticut the other day, and on the Merritt Expressway, bridges are falling down, and the roads suck. In my home state of Michigan, which isn't too far from you all, our country roads out there are awful.
Hmm.
Now, when they did the Super Bowl, they redid them in Detroit. But the rest of the state, the roads are a mess.
Hmm.
You know, and in my hometown there, which is in the lower part down by Ohio, the roads they put in when I was just a little snot-nose are still the roads that they're using, you know. And they haven't done much to them since. Now, we're willing as a country to go out and spend enormous amounts of money in any foreign country to fight any stupid war. But at the same time, we won't spend any money in the United States, where we need to be keeping our dollars here and improving our own infrastructure and what we're doing. So I do believe in some sort of a national policy, but we've never seen a national policy like that. Our country spends an enormous amount of money in taxes, and we get almost none of the benefits domestically from that. The bulk of our money goes overseas one way or another. We're paying it to the Middle East right now in terms of our war and in terms of our gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And we're keeping very little of that money here. And these are the parts of national policy that drive me batty. So I don't like subsidies per se, but I do believe that the government has a right to go in and work with companies, private industry, in terms of the infrastructure, which we need to keep this country going. And so far, neither presidential candidate has made that a priority.
Thanks, Bob, for the call. Let's go next to Chris from Green Bay. Hi, Chris.
Well, I was just wondering why the airlines are not buying on the futures market like the speculators. I mean, if they had bought 6 months ago or a year ago of their fuel, where you only have to put 10% down to buy a contract for hundreds of thousands of barrels, you wouldn't have this fuel crunch. They'd be budgeting money for a year out, 6 months out to buy a fuel. I'm kind of at a loss of why they don't do that.
Okay, a perfectly reasonable question there, kid. Let me give you the straightforward answer on that. To do a hedge and do it correctly, you have to know what the future is like. So you have to be able to look in your crystal ball and know pretty close what's going to happen 6 months and a year from now. So if you look at companies that have even done collars on stuff like this, where you're kind of betting both ways against it, on average, half of them lose. So we've seen one company be very good at it, Southwest, and we've seen others have a different percentage of it of luck, and some who've just been poor at it. So your ability to use a futures market to hedge against increases or decreases in cost, either way you're looking at it, is really a function of your being able to look into the future and divine that correctly. And all of us at one time or another look into the future and do it incorrectly.
Hmm. And
so
thank you.
There's risk even associated with that. It's not as simple as people think.
Thanks so much for your call, Chris. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Daryl Jenkins is our guest this hour, airline consultant, visiting professor at the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And we are looking at a major study that was done recently that looked at the airline industry and found that the future isn't terribly rosy and that a catastrophe looms under record oil prices. Current oil prices are near $130 a barrel, and several large and small U.S. airlines will default on their obligations to creditors beginning at the end of 2008 and early 2009. We'll talk about what airlines are doing and whether or not there should be some more regulation of the whole industry. Lines are filled. Just keep the number in mind, and we'll be with you as soon as we can. Or you can send an email, I believe, with that address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to phone calls now. Let's go to Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I guess I'm kind of confused about the whole topic, really. I mean, for years we've heard that we don't pay enough for gasoline, that it's not fair that the United States our cost is so little, and we actually needed a higher price for gasoline to reduce consumption, that environmentalists and the left have decried it for a long time, that we actually need to be paying $4 and $5 a gallon so that we can reduce our consumption of oil. So now that we're there, all of a sudden people are in panic mode. They can't believe, how can we be paying? I mean, isn't this what they've been saying for years that we needed. We really needed to get these prices up so we could reduce our consumption and damage the economy. So I'm just wondering what your guests have to say about that.
Well, that's a perfectly good statement, young man, and I think I'm going to let that stand on its own. Yet, okay.
All right.
Good observation, buddy.
Thanks for the call. Jason is on the road. Hi, Jason. Jason, are you there? Jason is off the road. Randy is next. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. See, I'm conflicted about this a little bit because, for example, the regional fleet of air carriers used to have very efficient but somewhat less pleasing prop jet planes, which I understand have relatives that fly. And I understand these prop jets can be 50 to 75% more efficient than the planes now they're replacing them with, which are, they mirror the wide-body jet. They're sleek, and they take a lot longer to take off and so on. The smaller prop jet was very, very efficient in terms of its fuel usage. So here we are complaining about the cost right when we're putting planes in the air that take two and three times the fuel, but yet we claim, well, we don't like it's a little less pleasing to fly on a prop jet. And from what I understand, those prop jets were very, very reliable, almost no accident with them. They're very reliable in the air, and the motors are very reliable and so on. So I guess I'd like to have you speak with that. Here, you wonder if all of a sudden we've got this high usage fleet, and prices are high, and now people are complaining. I agree with the last caller. Maybe this is sensitizing us that maybe we need to be a little less critical of what we see for our comfort or whatever, what we think is comfortable as Americans, and be happy. If I get on a regional prop jet in Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm able to fly to Chicago or Minneapolis, St. Paul reasonably, I guess I can put up with a little less aesthetics for that efficiency.
Daryl.
Well, the young man who just called in and make that statement, let him know that he can speak for me anytime. He's 100% in his observations. Let me give you some history on this. He being very young and me being very, very excessively old, have been through all these battles. And in the 1960s, in Congress, they held hearings, small communities complaining bitterly about having to fly in turboprops and they wanted jets. And that was one of the things that really kind of pushed us over sooner into regional jets than I think we would have had elsewise. But certainly a turboprop in terms of fuel consumption is much more efficient. I learned to fly on these. I love flying them. When I'm in a turboprop, I feel like I'm back in my mama again, especially going through turbulence. It's just she's walking over a bumpy road. So I love those planes, and I think over the next 5 years, I think you're going to see a lot of those coming out of mothballs. We see the Q400, which is a new turboprop. A lot of people switching to that, and I think over the next 5 to 10 years, I think we will see a return to those, and regional jets, especially the bigger ones used in other markets. And the small regional jet, the 35-seat to the 50-seat, are having almost no market whatsoever.
Thanks so much for the call. Here's another email. Bill from Madison. To what extent is getting more revenue supporting the existence / survival of the airlines versus giving stockholders a dividend?
Well, no stockholder in the airline industry gets a dividend. None of the airlines pay dividends.
Joe from Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I would just like to throw an idea out there. I think the airline industry is oversized and quite bloated. And in the 18th century, America threw a bunch of money at building the rail system to move us into the future of technology. And then in the 1950s, America threw another bunch of money at the highway system to move us into the future of transportation. And I think what needs to happen now is we need to throw just a whole bunch of money at building a transcontinental maglev system. It's clean. It runs on electric power.
What is it? I'm sorry, I missed what...
A maglev system. It's a train that runs on magnets. It's incredibly efficient. There's no friction caused by wheels. And very, very cheap to maintain and operate. The most expensive part is the upfront cost to build things. But America used to be a country where we would gain a new technology, and then we would use it, and we would build it. And we've had this maglev technology for 20 years, and we haven't just decided to step into the future and take a hold of what we have. And I think the airplanes are so expensive to operate, and these are so cheap to operate. It would open up travel to so many more people, and I'm waiting for somebody to finally do something about this.
Daryl.
Well, an interesting comment, and certainly some great observations there about adopting new technologies. You're a tad out of my area of expertise, so I think I'll have to pass on.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Daryl Jenkins is an airline consultant, visiting professor at the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and we're looking at reports that are showing that the snapshot of the industry is fairly grim. Airlines cutting fleets, jobs, and adding fees as they're trying to deal with the cost of jet fuel and also a weak domestic economy. Our phone number, lines have been jammed. There are a couple open right now, is 800-486-8655, or if you're in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Arnie is our next caller from Springstead. Hi, Arnie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, Arnie, how are you?
Taking my call.
Sure.
My first thing is, I'm wondering how many gallons of jet fuel does it take to move an airliner from East Coast to West Coast hauling about 400 people?
A perfectly good question. If you had asked me that last week, I could have given you an answer as we were doing those. So the numbers I used could be wrong. It seems like it's 1,200 to 1,500 gallons per hour. For something like that.
And how many hours will this take?
Well, four or five hours across coast to coast,
okay.
Depending on which way you're heading.
So it's really not much more expensive for fuel than riding a Greyhound. It would take eight Greyhounds to haul 400 people from east-west coast, and each one would use about 430 gallons. So there isn't really a lot of difference in fuel consumption, right?
Well, there's not. I don't know if that's correct or not. The differential is the 4 or 5 days that it would take versus the 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah,
I could see it more on a train going coast to coast, especially if it were, a true high speed one. I think that would be more viable. I don't know that people would want to take that much time. I think that would.
No, they wouldn't.
Yeah, they wouldn't. It's an interesting thought, though.
Now, I have one other thing.
Sure.
There's a report on the Internet of diesel fuel from algae. I got the report, and it started during the research during the Carter administration, but it was shut down in 95, 96 during the Clinton years, and I give Newt Gingrich, he had the standoff with Clinton, and he got his way in a lot of budget cuts, and that was one of the victims. They cataloged 300 types of seaweed algae. A lot of it produces up to 60% vegetable oil.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard much about it other than a few private companies trying to sell, investments to get into it. Why don't they work on that?
There are a couple places that are doing that. There's a research facility in the South. It's either in Georgia or Louisiana, where they're doing this cellulose conversion, and it's either done by algae or enzymes. Latest reports I've seen on this, since it's of great interest to me, is that we're still 5-10 years down the road, and probably you're correct, if they hadn't tanked that years ago when oil was cheap and we could have done this stuff, then we might be there by now. But the truth is, we're not there. We're not anywhere near where we want to be on energy dependency, and that's certainly a long-term viable alternative. And we just don't have a government in place, nor have we had one with either the Republicans or the Democrats. They're both culpable in this, that have looked out for our best interest in the long run.
Thanks so much for the call. Here's something I didn't know. If airlines, this is from Steve, If airlines need to save gas by cutting pounds, then quit painting them. This adds 2,000 pounds to the plane. American is the only airline that doesn't do that.
That's
true?
Correct.
Really?
Yeah, he's correct on that.
Huh. Well, so they should all do that then, right? Just the, all they have to do is write their name on it.
It does change the aerodynamics of the plane and does reduce weight. I don't know if it's a ton, as he stated. It's a reasonably big number. I was thinking it was 800-900 pounds, but the point is well taken.
Yeah, I guess. Hmm. Well, thanks, Arnie, very much for your call. We go to Gay next, who's on the road. Hi, Gay.
Hi, Kathleen and guests. First, I have to admit I'm no fan of air flight and, in fact, pretty phobic about it. Waiting for the hovercraft to Europe so I can go back to France. But anyhow, I was on the faculty of the scientist who studied the lack of contrails on 9/11 in the air and its effect on, you know, the weather and all kinds of things. It was UW-Whitewater, a colleague of mine. And I'm wondering, you know, if there might be, all of the things considered, some dividend for us environmentally if there are fewer flights and more trains, you know. Big fan of trains as well. So
It's a good question. I do not personally know the trade-offs on that. I know in the short run we don't have all the alternatives available. So what we need to find is a level at which we can have air travel going, and I think at the same time we should be looking at these other things. But being at the stage of life that I am, I hold out little hope that governments will do the correct things when they should.
Thank you.
All right, Gay, thanks so much for your
Thank
call.
You.
Matt from Middleton, hello.
Question is, does the airline industry have any alternative fuels available, you know, similar to autos or locomotives that could potentially run on ethanol or electricity? Is there anything other than jet fuel available now?
Okay, there are alternatives. The alternative is biodiesel, not ethanol. The problem with it is that we do not have any way to make it in sufficient quantities that we would have any land left in the United States left over for growing any food whatsoever. So until we come to a more, I mean, think of it this way. When you use the stalk of corn to make ethanol, the only thing that you put into the process is the corn of ear. And the stalk is really what we should be using because there's as much and more sugar in the stalk than there is in the ear. We just don't know how to take the sugar out of the stalk and be able to turn that into a proper biofuel. And we have people working on it. They tell me we're 5-10 years away from breakthrough. It may happen sooner, it may happen later. But in the meantime, we have, in the short run, no viable alternatives.
Okay.
Thanks very much for your call. Can you outline sort of the best and the worst scenarios here when it comes to the airline industry over the next couple of years, Daryl?
Well, I don't know if there is a best one. I mean,
really?
a best one may be that one of the large guys goes out of business and all the others share the traffic and they're able to do it at a fair level where they all are able to go on happily into the future. And we just have fewer flights than we've ever had before in places like Orlando and Vegas and Hawaii just have to suck it in.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that might be a best scenario. I don't think the worst scenario is that we will lose all of the airlines. I just don't see that whatsoever because it's a dynamic process if one were to fail. And after 9/11, I think I was probably the only guy out there rooting for an airline to fail. And I was opposed to the government bailout. The airlines had way overexpanded. I don't think government should pay for the silliness of any company, be it an airline or anyone else. What I would like to see, though, and this is my best hope scenario, which I probably have little faith in happening, is that we will have a reasonable government policy which will bring prices of fuel down to a point at which we can which we can transport goods to the market, in which we can fly to the markets that we need to do business and have a leisure vacation now and then. But I think there's a less likelihood of that happening. So the best outcome is the government's working in an enlightened manner The worst outcome is we may lose a big airline, and if we do, everybody else flies into the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much, Daryl, for being with us.
My pleasure, young lady.
Daryl Jenkins, airline consultant and a visiting professor at the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, looking at these reports. And, of course, those of you who fly a lot know that it's not very easy to fly a lot these days in the industry with oil at this huge, huge record level. The cost of flying is quite something, and there are airlines laying people off and aircraft that are not flying right now simply because of the price of oil, which is something that may go up. Current oil price is near $130 a barrel, and that could go up, some are saying, even as much as $200 a barrel in the coming months after crossing $100 for the first time in January. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to John Anderson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your very informed and interesting calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Many more interesting hours of conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.